Hello and welcome to Tools in the Shed, a podcast powered by Cars Guide Radio Ripping and Caster that's caught our eye this week. I'm Cars Guide Deputy Editor James, and with me, the Senior Editor Matt.
Hello.
And Deputy News Editor Justin.
Hello.
This week, we're looking at the next N-line brick in the increasingly imposing Hyundai performance wall. We'll cover off three recent entrants to the Cars Guide Garage, and we'll check in on the world's newest tequila entrepreneur in this week's Must Watch. So stay with us. First of all, we will go to our main topic of conversation, which is all about Hyundai, as I mentioned, and N-line seems to be an increasing focus for the Korean brand. And Matt, you've been this week investigating further. You had the opportunity to get a sneak peek of something. Tell us all about it, please.
Big time. It was the Sonata N-Line, which is going to be the only Sonata available in Australia this time around. So that signals some intent to me that Hyundai has realised that the sedan market, which has been, you know, doing the downward trend for a long time, there's still a point to be made in that part of the market. And performance is going to be Hyundai's point that it's making in that zone. I think we're going to see more and more of this from different brands moving forward. You know, the likes of the Mazda 6, for example, the next generation version is touted to be getting this new inline six-cylinder engine with hybrid and all that sort of stuff. So there is going to always be a market for the sedan. It is shrinking the size of that market, and the vehicles themselves are actually getting bigger as well. And this new Sonata N-Line is a performance-focused car, and that's what the N-Line brand is all about. You know, it's got a 2.5-litre four-cylinder turbo with, 213 kilowatts and 422 newton
metres? That's heaps.
That's more than a lot. So, compared to the old 2-litre version, which wasn't a performance model, it was the premium version of the Sonata, which a 2-litre turbo, 180 kilowatts and 353 newton metres. So we're seeing sizable jumps in terms of performance. It won't just be the look of it. It's not just the engine. Of course, it's going to have a specific N-line suspension and steering tune, but it's not an Australian-specific tune this time around.
Right.
Hyundai said that basically the global tune was good enough for what their parameters were for an Australian tune. So maybe the Australian tuning thing is less important for less important cars, you might say, and it needs to be focused on things like Tucson and that when those models come.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Matt. Is it the only Sonata that we're going to see in Australia? Is this N-line model?
Yep, correct. So this new generation model, which has been out for nearly 18 months, I believe, in Korea. It's the only one we're getting. And what do you reckon, Justin? I don't think that's a bad thing.
No, not at all. I mean, previously, the Hyundai Australia obviously had plans to have regular variants, if you will, of the Sonata. And obviously, they've been scrapped in more recent times. But yeah, if you were going to get any version of the Sonata, it would surely be the N-line, because those types of people that are still buying sedans are probably enthusiastic about having a sedan and therefore probably more likely to go and try and buy a performance variety of a sedan, perhaps. So it's fits really well within that, I think. And I'm excited to drive it when it comes here.
Yeah, and I think we all are. It's such an interesting looking car, obviously with those LED strips that turn to chrome magically up through the bonnet. That chrome strip has been a real thing for Sonata for a few generations now, and good on them for sticking to it. I don't necessarily think it's gorgeous design, but it is such an interesting car in a very small market segment that it's going to catch people's eye. And I think that's what N-Line needs to do in particular. They need to have interesting looking cars. The N product portfolio, JC, as we know, is going to expand over the next few years. We're going to see new i30N very soon with the DCT. i30N sedan is also coming as well. But does that mean we lose the fastback?
Yes. So I don't think Hyundai Australia has officially announced it, but certainly our understanding is the fastback isn't coming to Australia in facelifted form. Obviously, when the i30 in hatch was originally launched, it was followed soon after by the fastback in Australia, but that will only last half a life cycle here. It's not going to come back, but it might come back as like a special slash limited edition further down the line, but it's certainly not going to be a permanent offering. So effectively the i30 sedan N, to call it by its proper name, is going to replace the i30 fastback N in Australia. Yeah.
And Matt, to me, it feels like this is the Albert Bierman factor, that he's come into the organisation and he's just started doing what he does, which is making everything go fast and what have you, which is no bad thing, but it feels like he's had a massive influence.
Definitely. And if you're not aware of who Albert Bierman is, he's the former head of BMW M and is now the head of the performance division for Hyundai globally. And so that's right, exactly. He needs to expand his product portfolio, and that expands the market presence in different sections of the market. I mean, we've seen the Tucson N line teasers and stuff. So it looks like it's going to be an interesting car as well. Wonder if it'll get the same big engine and all that sort of gear as well. But there's no doubt that Hyundai as a brand is changing perceptions in different parts of the market with its design. I mean, there's also the i20N coming, which Chesto's done a prototype drive of, and he was blown away by it. All the reports seem to suggest that, you know, up against the likes of a Ford Fiesta ST, that is a really compelling little car. And also an interesting looking car. So, you know, it makes me wonder, how far can this N-line portfolio spread?
I reckon that's a really interesting point, because my mind goes to, all right, now you've got N-line and you've got N. You know, Toyota has GR and then they've got MN. I wonder if N goes to another level and we get something even more focused out of them. And it's entirely possible, I reckon.
There's a supercar coming from Hyundai, a mid-engined electric engine,
that's
if you will.
That's right. That's right.
I can't believe how many times I just said engine. But with Rimac, which is a Croatian specialist in high-performance electric vehicles, so they have a partnership with them. And it's been on the record before with various concepts and speaking about this new N flagship that's going to come in the future, that's going to be a proper dedicated sports car, probably all electric, given the Rimac partnership. And, you know, that's going to be a genuine bit of kit. It'll be interesting to see how it's positioned, because on paper, certainly the way they describe it, it sounds like, you know, a proper sports car that's going to cost a pretty penny and not, you know, kind of mainstream hot hatch, if you will. It's going to be very interesting to see very soon where that goes.
And the other question that comes to my mind, Matt, is we made some obvious kind of comparisons between this Sonata and the Kia Stinger. The fundamental difference being the driven wheels, you know, the Stinger being the traditional front engine rear wheel drive, this one's still sticking with front wheel drive. What did Hyundai have to say about that? I mean, to me, it doesn't seem a big stretch to make something all-wheel drive. Was there any talk of that?
Yeah, no mention of that. I don't necessarily think that that's a global consideration either. But I don't know whether there is. Honestly, I don't know whether there is an all-wheel drive take on Sonata in the world.
Yeah.
But they have the rear-wheel drive platform, which allows all-wheel drive in their higher-spec sedans in Korea. Yeah. So they've got above the Sonata, there's a, I don't know if it's called Grandeur anymore, but there's one above it, and I think there's another one above it. So there's a whole range of sedans in the Hyundai lineup that we don't get in Australia because, as we've said, the market just isn't there. There is the likes of the i30 sedan, which is formerly the Elantra, but this Sonata, and that's about it really in the world of passenger sedans. But I was thinking about it when I was filming this this Sonata N line, and I'm thinking back to a date when they did a Santa Fe SR a few years ago, like 6 or 7 years ago, probably maybe even longer. And it had, you know, it had bigger wheels, had bigger brakes, had stiffer suspension, I believe. but just the same engine and that. So this was, SR was basically what M-Line is today. It was the
It was the start of it all, really.
Yeah. And in Australia, it was, you know, the, I know that there was a lot of brand value in the SR badge, so it must have hurt to have to change it to this new global M-Line brand. But it is a global move, and this is part of a very big global strategy. So I think it's only a matter of time. If we're seeing a Tucson M-Line, then maybe we'll see a Santa Fe M-Line. Yeah. Maybe there'll be a Palisade M-Line.
Who knows?
So it's just going to keep growing.
The only reason I mention all-wheel drive is I do remember talking to a person inside on the engineering side of Hyundai, talking about how basically a Tucson all-wheel drive rear end will just bolt into an i30, more or less. You know, that you can make that car all-wheel drive without too many headaches. Yeah. And I would have thought that might be possible elsewhere, given that they've so much commonality in platforms and powertrains and things. Yeah. You wouldn't be terribly surprised to see it happen with this Sonata.
Probably not, but it seems to me that they're happy with front-wheel drive for this car. And maybe, who knows, there's going to be all-wheel drive performance models across different variants in the range. But I don't know whether honestly, I'm not really sure whether the market in say, a $50,000 Hyundai sedan is demanding of the sort of all-wheel drive traction that we would want with that sort of power. And we've seen so many cars now that are front-wheel drive with 200 to 250 kilowatts of power that can manage it really well. It is surprising. Like, you look back 10 years and any car with 200 kilowatts at the front wheels was a tire burner.
Well,
400... That's 3 MPS.
Yeah.
400 plus Newton meters of torque. That's a massive amount to be putting through the front wheels.
Yeah.
And managing it effectively and getting it on the ground. So, you know, hats off for that. But that kind of output, not all that long ago, was V8 territory for sure. You know,
absolutely.
Hit that. It's quite a big four cylinder. You know, 2.5 liters. They're big. Mm-hmm. They're big pots, but still 422. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. In terms of N and all-wheel drive, though, let's not forget the Kona N's not that far away either. It hasn't been officially revealed yet, but certainly the expectation is that will be all-wheel drive, and that's going to be the kind of first time we see that i30 N package. With all-wheel drive, again, not confirmed, but that is certainly the expectation that, you know, an all-wheel drive Kona is currently available, so that the N flagship will also probably be all-wheel drive as well. It might not be, but so there's a strong chance.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be funny if it was rear-wheel drive?
Now, that would be unexpected.
Yeah.
But I suppose it's part putting some luster on the Hyundai brand, isn't it? And part selling some cars, you know, shifting some metal and broadening your appeal. So, as to what the ultimate end goal is, time will tell, but it's probably doing both things at the moment.
Yeah, and I've just been thinking more and more about how the strategy with sedans is playing out for different brands, and the likes of this new i30 sedan, which is 4.6 metres long. It is not a small car. Mazda 3 sedan's really long as well. That whole segment of small sedan is no longer a small car. They're more like mid-sized sedans now. And that leaves me to think that maybe the i30 sedan will be playing the fleet role that the previous versions of Sonata would have. And they've just gone, well, we'll aim for the private buyer base, which was buying the top spec anyway, the 42 grand version of the Sonata. This one's going to be even more performance oriented. It's going to be more desirable. It's going to be more high tech, more luxurious, all those things. Yeah. So it gives them an even more unique buyer experience. You know, they're not seeing a low spec Sonata driving around and them going, well, why do I pay the extra 12 grand for this one? If it just, you know, they're the same sort of car. So yeah, it's an interesting
trouble point. Do they run into trouble though by having the i30 sedan in and the Sonata in line, probably quite closely positioned to one another in terms of price, you would assume. One being an actual N, the other being an N line. Still a performance upgrade, sure, but not a full fat N.
Yeah.
You've got to imagine that they're not going to, I would assume the Sonata is probably going to be a little pricier than the i30 sedan N, but they won't be too different in terms of price. And considering how almost similar they are in size, like,
yes,
not too different, you know, that could be interesting.
The life of a product planner is, you know, getting all those things to mesh so that you have a meaningful and attractive range of models without too much clashing of teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. I don't envy them, but I also wish I was one.
Absolutely.
Well, the range that you would produce M4 would be fascinating.
It would be amazing.
All right. I think what we'll do is move on, but we'll ask people listening or viewing on YouTube to give us their thoughts. You know, what are you making of the whole rise of this N and N line part of Hyundai? Is it changing the brand for you, or where do you see it? So it'd be great to get people's thoughts.
Yeah.
And we'll also move on to our garage and the cars that we have in fact been driving this week. And Justin, you've been slumming it. You've been in, you know, a fairly sluggish, low-key kind of a vehicle. Tell us what you've been in.
Unfortunately, I've had to spend a couple of days and the rest of the coming week in the new Audi RS7 Sportback, which is, to your point, a bit of a snail when it comes to a straight line. It is obviously a fairly desirable car in the Audi range. RS7 sitting at the top of the A7 range, of course. But yeah, we're talking, of course, about a 4-litre twin turbo V8 under the bonnet, 441 kilowatts, 800 newton-meters, 3.6 seconds to 100. So yeah, it's not exactly slow.
Yeah.
Which is great. But one thing I find funny about this car is obviously, yes, it is very fast. It's got a big V8 under the bonnet with a couple of turbos, all that kind of stuff. But it also is a mild hybrid at the same time.
Yes.
So it's not your Toyota self-charging hybrid or a plug-in hybrid. It's the mildest version, as the name suggests. But it's funny that they've bothered to put that technology in a car like this. And obviously Europe and the regulations over there is probably a key reason why that's the case. But it's just interesting to see that there is this kind of electric element to it, you know. Yep. The engine cuts off at 22 k's an hour when you're decelerating, so it comes with the traffic lights and the engine's already off and has been for a little bit. You know, it coasts and turns the engine off. Like, it's geared towards trying to be not so bad for the environment, but when you actually stick the boot in, it goes. Like hell. That side of it is interesting. But what amazes me is it's just... it's a jack of all trades, you know. It's a comfortable cruiser. It looks great, luxurious, high tech. Mm. Obviously, we know the performance is there. It's nice to drive. Like, there's really not a lot to hate.
Magnificent
about that car.
Well, what about the price tag, amazing, mate? You might be a bit hard to stomach that one.
Well, unfortunately, I can't afford one because if I could, I may have bought one. But yeah, no, the price tag is $224,000 before on-roads in Australia. So, you know, this particular car I have has quite a few options fitted, option packages that are about $20,000 each. So I think this one's about $260,000 before on-roads. So it's basically a $300,000 car by the time you get it in your driveway with the options this one has.
Yes.
So yeah, it costs pretty pennies. So yeah, it's expensive, but it is cheaper than the previous RS7, which had less stuff in it. So if anything, it's better value than it used to be, but it's still a bit unattainable, certainly for people like me who want to own one but can't, unless it was quite old. You know, at the same time, it is desirable. But the one thing I would say that is an actual negative in my mind about the RS7 is it's not the RS6 Avant, which of course is the wagon version basically of the same car, based on the A6 Avant. And it's $8,000 cheaper, the RS6, than the, compared to the RS7, which doesn't really make sense because arguably the Avant, you actually get more car than you do with the RS7.
But
you pay a premium for being stylish. So I would personally save the $8,000 and go with the RS6 Avant because that is uber cool.
Well, you're preaching to the converted here because I can speak on M4's behalf. That's such a fantastic car, the RS6 Avant. Am I correct, Matt?
You are 100% correct. James and I were lucky enough a few months ago to spend a bit of time in both cars and swap them halfway through the loan. So which one did you start off with? The wagon?
The RS6, yeah.
Yeah, and I started off with the RS7. And, you know, I can see a user case and a scenario for both of those cars, but on the same, I would choose the wagon just because I like the look of it more. I think it has more presence. I've always wanted an RS6, and it just ticks so many boxes for me. So.
And at the end of the day as well, it's a motoring journalism cliche to want to have a performance wagon as well. So it would be rude not to want the RS6.
You know, I was going to say with regard to that mild electrification in this car, you know, we're all kind of separated internationally now. We in Australia are in a kind of bubble all of our own, but you forget how tuned into, you know, those kinds of emissions and consumption issues Europe is in total. And even on a car like that, to get a corporate kind of average lowering down, it's important. I suppose it's just a reminder of that factor as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with that particular car and a lot of Audis with that mild hybrid system, it only reduces fuel consumption by, I think it's 0.4 litres per 100 kilometres. So it is negligible. But when you think about it from a corporate fleet emissions perspective,
that's right.
0.4 litres per 100 actually makes a big difference for them. Again, it's all geared for Europe. We just get what we're given in Australia, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting because, again, it doesn't make sense for that kind of car at the moment, being it's the mildest form of electrification. But interesting nonetheless.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Well, brilliant. Thank you very much for that, Justin. And M4, we will move to you. We're not in Europe now. We've gone to a different place. You've been immersing yourself in this vehicle. Tell us all about it.
I have the Honda CR-V, the 2021 version of the CR-V, which unless you know the differences, you might struggle to pick them because it is a facelift of the car. It's not a overhaul per se. It does get a slightly different look. There's like a little mustache that runs, which is a common theme I'm seeing on a lot of cars these days, is there's these sort of thing that runs down and then it wisps up at the edges. I'm guessing there's some sort of aero benefit, but also it's a design trait at the moment. So there's that. You get a new grille, you get different wheels on the one that you'll be seeing on YouTube.
What, if you're watching. In each corner, you get a different wheel.
Yeah.
That's,
you get four of them.
Wow. That is unusual, but a different design at each corner. Love it.
Yeah. No, no. So you get there are different wheel designs available across the range.
Okay. Yep.
The version that I had is the VTI LX all-wheel drive, the top spec, at $47,490, which is a lot of money. It had the biggest wheels, the 19s, which you'll be seeing on YouTube if you're watching there. And there's also a new tail light look, which is basically like you saw in the HRV. It went to a sort of smoked tail light look, a few other different features inside. Not much has changed except for the center console's been redesigned, so it's easy to put your USBs in. Nothing's changed in terms of the media system. It's a 7-inch screen, which is small by class standards now, but it's still got Apple CarPlay and Android Auto across every model in the range now. This is the important part. The base model car, the VI, it finally gets the big screen, but it misses out on all the safety kit that you get on the other models in the range. And it also misses out on the engine that you get in the VTI and up. So there's this VI model, to me, just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't fit with the brand value of, you know, trying to offer safety to people and trying to offer a good engine to people. Just seems to me like, I mean, there might be a very small fleet market there for Honda to play in, but it's putting the brand's cachet and reputation at risk by still offering cars that don't have active safety technology in 2020 for a 2021 model year.
Yeah.
Like if that car was tested under ANCAP's current testing regime, it would get three stars, which I know I wouldn't be happy recommending any one of my family members to be buying. You know, if you can afford a car brand new, there are so many other options out there in this segment that have better safety technology. And that's across the range. Like there's still no blind spot monitoring, still no rear cross traffic alert, still no rear AEB. It's still missing a few other crucial items as well.
The thing there is, Matt, it puts me in mind of when airbags started to emerge and, you know, often they were optional. You know, ABS was optional. A passenger airbag was optional. And that quickly became, people saw it through quite cynical eyes, you know, that surely it doesn't cost you that much to put these essential safety items into the car. I reckon we're in similar territory here because those things have been developed to a point where they're often off the shelf from a Bosch or from someone else. I'm not sure how much is developed in-house, but it can't be a massive price impost to put some of them into a car, you know?
I wouldn't think so, and especially when Honda's decided to put prices up across the range anyway. So the top spec one is now $4,000 more or something, and it doesn't feel like you're getting 10% more stuff. So it is an interesting car. It's a really good practical family model. There's no doubt about that, but it is not up to date with its competitors. A RAV4 is a better car and on multiple levels. A Forester has better safety. A CX-5 has better safety, even though it's a very old car in the segment. And all and across every single model.
All of those have the same wheel at each corner as well.
They do.
That's one advantage, I suppose. So.
They just have one wheel and it jumps between corners.
Amazing. All right, well, I think we'll move on. I'll just thank you, Matt. We'll I can tip in at the end here. I've been in the Mitsubishi Outlander PHEV, better known as the FEV. This is a new model, the GSR. The FEV is not exactly a spring chicken. It's been around since 2014, and it's due for an all-new model in the first part of next year. So this GSR has been introduced to keep momentum going, generate some interest in the car as it gets towards the end of its run. It's a $52,490 car in Australia, but at the time that we're of launch, it's $56,490 drive away. So it's up in that mid $50,000 bracket. So you've got the combination of a 2.4-litre petrol engine and then two motors, one on each axle, single speed auto, and it can operate in EV only, in series where the engine is operating as a generator, topping up the battery, and parallel where it puts everything on the table. And you've got the motors and the engine directly driving the front wheels, but it is all-wheel drive. So the overall number is about 157 kilowatts, 322 newton meters, so not bad. But the GSR, you know, for a lot of people, that has some history with Mitsubishi, and it has those kinds of performance and sporting overtones. So this one gets a Bilstein-tuned suspension. It's got, struts and shocks and re-rated springs and what have you. And some little blacked out bits on the car make it look a bit sporty. And so we'll get to that. But on the plus column for it, I really enjoy in a lot of PHEVs is the adjustable regen on the braking. So you have paddles on the wheel or column that look like they're for gears, but actually they're to modify the amount of regenerative braking you've got, and you can charge the battery by doing that. Love playing with that.
Yeah.
The interior of this GSR is beautiful. It's got this microfiber inserts in the seats that are kind of little rolls that look really sporty, and they're pretty comfy. So for a 1.7-ton SUV, I got 5.9 litres per 100 for the week, which was a combination of running it on pure EV and then running it on the motor for a while. They claim 1.9 litres, mind you, per 100. So
That's
all about that first 100 kilometres where your EV range is about 54, 55 kilometres, and then you're doing the last bit on petrol. But in the real world, 5.9 is what you can probably expect. But for four recharges, which will get you about 200 kilometres in energy, a Canstar Blue average energy rating, it'll cost you about $14.50. To go 200 kilometres is by my calculation.
Which is not bad.
Not bad at all. And this model also, it's a reasonable chunk of change, but it is good value. It is loaded. It's loaded in terms of its straight-up equipment and safety. And you're getting the Mitsubishi in Australia, a 10-year warranty as well. So it's offering a pretty compelling value package. Then we get to the sporty bit. And in the minus column, I would say it's not exactly sporty. The steering is still tremendously numb. You're not getting any real road feel from the front wheels. Yes, it's quick enough, but it's not an urgent kind of sporty drive.
Yeah.
Also driving, you feel as though it is getting old. It is showing its age. There's no digital speedometer, for example. And in this day and age, it just feels like that's essential to make sure that you're always within the speed limit. It's efficient and it's comfy, but I didn't necessarily find it inspiring. It's a bit of fun, and it serves its purpose pretty well, but, you know, there it is.
Luckily, they didn't call it a rally art, I guess.
that would be a bridge too far.
But, JC, I'll just also point out a lot of people who would be buying a plug-in hybrid like this will have solar panels on their roof. So the electricity could actually be free.
Well, that's a good point.
Costs could be $0 if if that's your user case and you're only doing 50Ks a day or whatever it may be, or 50Ks to work, you plug it in at work and they pay the bill. Happy days.
Absolutely. So. A sneaky, oh, there's a 3-point pin. I'll just plug that in. But funnily enough, where I live in Sydney, it's about 22 kilometres to the city. So it's a 44-kilometre round trip. You're well within range for the battery only. Mm-hmm. So you can conceivably, if you're a commuter to work, you can run on EV power till the cows come home, you know.
There you go.
So I do like that. For me, the plug-in hybrid is a fantastic stepping stone to a full electric future. Yeah. I get where Toyota is with hybrid. I know it's an extra thing that you have to do each day, but I quite like it. I really enjoy that technology.
On the GSR front, JC, how does it ride?
Look, it's not too bad. It's a little bit jittery with high frequency imperfections in the road, but it's far from harsh. I found it to be pretty good overall. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So, but you're not getting that. You think Bilstein suspension, you think GSR, you think, oh, it's going to be really racy, and then you grab the steering wheel and turn into a corner and go, what's happening? will this happen? There's just not that immediacy of the drive, if you know what I mean.
I think that's been a bit of a trait of Mitsubishi SUVs for a long time.
So
it's not quite as direct as some of their rivals.
No, it's there in force, put it that way. Or it's not, depending on your point of view. Now, what we'll do now is just touch relatively briefly on some feedback that we had on last week's episode. Mm-hmm. And we were speaking about Hyundai's potential move into Toyota Land Cruiser territory, building a body-on-frame, large, off-road capable SUV. And it generated quite a lot of thoughts from viewers and listeners. And Peter Crott said, if any company can challenge Toyota's dominance in Australia, it's Hyundai. Look how far they've come in a relatively short period of time. This will just make competition better, better cars with cheaper prices. We all win. And it's hard to argue with him on that front.
Yeah.
But Neza, our old mate Neza, said, I think Hyundai has a bit of leeway in costs because we're talking about can they bring it to market to undercut the Land Cruiser, whether it's an investment for them in exploring a new market territory. And he made the point that the steel that might go into that car could be at an attractive price because Hyundai, of course, is also a steel maker.
Yep.
And they are very good in terms of high-strength steels and putting those in their vehicles. If anyone could make a vehicle tougher than the Hilux or Land Cruiser, his bet would be on Hyundai or Kia. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting perspective, I thought.
I think the other side of it is the reason that the Land Cruiser in Australia has this reputation is that, A, they're pretty hard to break. They last 500,000 Ks. You probably could not do an oil change and it'd be fine for 500,000 Ks. Mm-hmm. But if you do get stuck somewhere in outback New South Wales or outback Australia, anywhere, there's a dealership somewhere. So Toyota dealership.
There are parts at the milk bar as well available.
Exactly, yeah. So there's a spread of dealerships all over the nation that just allow that peace of mind. If something does go wrong, I would argue that maybe like Mitsubishi might be the next best in terms of Australian spread of dealership footprint. But yeah, Hyundai's definitely growing in Australia and growing its presence. So
yeah. You're right. I mean, that is a Toyota. Whether its perception is everything. You know, there's reality in there, but also it's become folklore that, you know, Toyota can, everyone knows how to work on a Toyota, your corner mechanic, not just the dealers. So there's that. It's very much in Toyota's favour at the moment. You're right.
Yep.
Jim Danick says, this is not Hyundai's first go at a ladder frame four-wheel drive. They sold the Terracan in Oz from 2001 to 2007. And what a wonderfully awkward looking vehicle that was. but he's right. Thank you, Jim, for that reminder. Then Places to See, spelt S-E-A at the end, Places to See, Hyundai have also made a four-wheel drive H1 Starex. So H1 is the global naming for the iLoad.
Yep.
Something that he believes should have come to Australia and ideally should now, but with more towing capacity. Maybe with six-cylinder diesel at a realistic price, they'd be great when you drive the East Coast, etc. All you see are 200 series Land Cruisers used for towing. So a Hyundai four-wheel drive would need similar towing capacity and larger payload. So yeah, absolutely right. But we've got a picture for people on YouTube of the Star X, and lo and behold, it looks exactly like an iLoad.
Yes.
With
yes.
Slightly different wheels. So that's an interesting one too.
Well, the six-cylinder thing is also with that Genesis six-cylinder that we've seen in the GEV80, that theoretically could be a really good fit for that sort of application.
Yes, absolutely.
Big outputs, very refined, very nice driving. So, interesting.
Now the next couple of comments relate to a story that our very own Byron Mathiudakis has written. So I'll run through the comments, then we'll talk about Byron's story and how it addresses these thoughts. So Wax 333, our old mate Wax 333 and a loyal Kiwi, says Hyundai will need to prove it can compete with the Land Cruiser in the real world, not just on paper. It'd be a very tough sell in the first few years, but if Hyundai can stick to it and keep refining the vehicle, the numbers will start climbing. Will we see a Hyundai Ute anytime soon? So hold that thought. And Grudland74 says Hyundai could take a leaf out of Isuzu's book by releasing a rugged dual cab Ute and then an SUV body on top, but still thinks the Santa Cruz has a business case here in Oz. So Byron just recently wrote a news story that says there's a still secret one-ton truck employing a ladder frame chassis lurking around in Hyundai, rumored to hit the streets sometime in 2023. And Byron has various Hyundai Australian executives saying it can't come to Australia quick enough. They're on the record saying that. And the Santa Cruz, much as all I'd been thinking that was a bit of a no-go zone for Australia, that aims to kind of reinvent the Ute as a civilized getaway machine, a little bit like the Subaru Brumby, Proton Jumbuck, but slightly larger and a little more sophisticated. A monocoque body construction rather than the frame, body on frame. Advanced suspension and mainly four-cylinder engine choices, it's still undecided for Australia and other right-hand drive markets is Byron's mail. So very interesting to see whether it may indeed get up here. It's a slim chance, he says, but if the Palisade fires, and bear in mind that was a car that was never intended or was never going to come to Australia, and lo and behold, it has, Byron says you never know. So it still could happen.
I would argue the Palisade was more of a challenge to get to right-hand drive than the Santa Cruz would be, because the Santa Cruz inevitably will share its platform with the new Tucson, I believe.
Yeah.
And obviously we have a Tucson in Australia, so I would assume that it would be far easier for them to offer a right-hand drive version of the Santa Cruz than it was the Palisade, which required, you know, retooling of factories just for one market, so on and so forth. So, on paper, it seems a lot more possible. Whether it will happen, time will tell. But
it's interesting. One of the many things I admire about Byron is that he just doesn't take things at face value. I think one of my shortcomings is if an executive says to me, look, nah, it's never coming here, I'll go, all right, it's never coming here. Whereas Byron thinks, really?
Yeah.
And is consistently digging a bit further. I remember when he used to prod Nissan occasionally about Duke. Come on, you've got to bring Duke here. Are you going to bring Duke? No, no, no. And what happened? You know, the Duke came here.
Yeah.
And that is his approach. And so he's been probing around on Hyundai with these things. So you never know.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Now, finally, Lofty Visions from A Great Height has said, forget Hyundai. I'd like to see what Kia's version will look like. Always preferred Peter Schreyer's designs over Hyundai's busy design language. But I should say, I think Peter Schreyer has oversight on all of Hyundai and Kia design at this point.
Yeah.
Have you seen the renders, rhetorical question, have you seen the renders of the new Sportage fire emoji? You don't have to look too far. And Lofty makes a good point that Kia would presumably be riding in parallel with some of this same stuff.
Yep, 100%. It's they are a group. They may be different brands, but Hyundai Motor Corporation is a group. And so you will expect maybe there would be Hyundai, Kia, Genesis, Ioniq, who knows? Who knows how far these things could spread? So
exactly. If you want to make your investment pay off, you've got to amortize it as far and wide as you can. So you'd think it would be going there. But speaking of amortizing far and wide, it's time for MuskWatch.
Tequila.
Now, first of all, a really interesting story published on Vanity Fair this week by a guy called Nick Bilton. And he's basically saying, he's recounting 2020 from an Elon point of view and saying what a weird and wonderful year it was for him. But he actually called out a turning point being just outside of 2020. It was December 2019 when Elon, against all expectations, won the pedo guy defamation case in Los Angeles. And he decided at that point, according to Nick, to go in hard on his perceived enemies. Like, that just gave him a license to forget it. I don't care what you think. I'm just going to do what I want to do. And in the interim, he has sacked his external PR agency for Tesla, stopped hiring for openings in his communications team, disbanded the PR department, blanket blocked many of the journalists who'd covered that Vernon Unsworth trial about the pedo guy tweet. And Elon is his own communications director now. So it's like we're getting pure, unadulterated Elon. And he's had a lot to say about COVID reporting and lockdowns and the impact that they have had. But according to this story, to everyone watching, it seemed as if Musk was finally unraveling from the pressure of his mission to save the world. And this is Nick talking to various people who are in Elon's orbit saying, the thing about Elon is that right now, everyone else is finally seeing the way he's always been. This is a former Tesla executive. He's just being Elon a lot more publicly. So we've had these kinds of meltdowns with no filter to stop it just getting out into the public realm. All of these guys, I've spent time with them, Musk, Zuck, all of them, they all exhibit tendencies of total and complete pathological sociopathy. They don't, at their core, give a flying fuck about you or me as individuals.
Yes. Well, is this news to anyone?
Yeah, just to say, it's pretty obvious.
It might be. And look, some close to him, according to the story, are saying that the behaviour that's on display through 2020, it's been quite erratic. It's because of substances that he might have been consuming, alcohol, marijuana, that he obsesses about on social media. Or LSD, as that singer Azalea Banks claimed and Musk has since denied, or Ambien, which he's been quite upfront about using. So whatever his drug of choice, several executives have told the author that employees at all of his companies check Musk's Twitter account first thing in the morning to see what disaster happened the night before and to decipher it will lead to a new lawsuit, affect Tesla's stock price, or add to growing public resentment toward their CEO. So, for example, if you're at Tesla, everybody watches the next SpaceX launch because they know if it goes well, Elon's going to be in a great mood and all these budget requests go into his desk, you know, while the window of opportunity is open. But if it doesn't, people just keep their head down and cower because things don't go so well. Really revealing and very interesting story.
Yeah, wow.
But one thing that has come to pass is Tesla Keeler. Now, it in fact started as an April Fool's joke that
everything he does.
We're going to get into the Tesla. Have we said juvenile sense of humor? Anyway, he was going to get into making a tequila. It's happened. It sold out in hours. It was US$250 a bottle, which is about $340 a bottle Australian. Now, it's not known exactly how many bottles were produced, so it could be half a dozen. I'm not sure, but it sold out in hours. They're already selling for as much as $999 secondhand. So whether there's a second bottling, who knows? But it's in the bottle is in the shape of a lightning bolt on a very nifty little alloy plinth and looks amazing. And so there you go. He's actually followed through and made the Tesla Keeler.
Oh, it'll be good to fuel the flamethrowers with, I guess.
That was a big seller. Absolutely. Oh, rockets, exactly. Rockets.
Yeah.
The Tesla share price is now $413.13. It was $420.98 last week, but it got up to a high of about $449 on Tuesday. But it's still in the same band. We're not getting the volatility that that we once saw over the last several weeks. In fact, a couple of months, it's been pretty steady as she goes.
Yep.
I found three different news outlets that were running on a similar theme. Stock News, for example, said Tesla versus Ford, which stock is better to buy? And their conclusion was Ford. CNN Business, want to invest in electric cars? GM could be a better bet than Tesla. And on balance, they came down on the side of GM with things like Hummer and other initiatives that they're developing. And Yahoo Finance, will Tesla or NIO stock grow more by 2025? It's NIO.
Yeah.
So it feels as though, yes, it's established, it's gone to this stratospheric high, but at the moment there are some question marks as competitors get a bit more serious as to whether or not that steep ascension can continue.
And NIO is that electric motorbike and scooter brand.
Correct.
Which was valued, what, sixth most valuable automotive company on the planet. Nobody's heard of it. Like, how can it be?
Except that Muskwatch viewers and listeners, because we did touch on it a few weeks ago. But absolutely.
I remember at a motor show a few years ago, I walked up. It was actually in Korea. You were there, Justin. You were working for a competitor at that time. We walked in, and there was the NIO stand was there. And to me, this looked like, you know, a kind of a knockoff brand, the sort of brand that is making things that no one's buying yet and hasn't really figured out how it's going forward. But, I mean, personal mobility devices, be they electric push scooters, be they electric push bikes or skateboards, all these little electric scooters that can do 50 Ks an hour and are perfect for urban drivers.
Yeah.
There's a future in that, I think. So if they could just get ones that are like a little bubble and like a pod, I'll be there.
Particularly in these COVID times, a bit of protection while you're scootering.
Oh, and climate change, you know.
Well, that's
it. M4 becomes the boy in the bubble.
Oh, where I want to be.
That's true. We did a few weeks ago cover off NIO as being a red hot kind of tip in terms of if you want to buy into electric mobility, park Tesla for a while, think about NIO because it has so much headroom and so much growth potential. So,
am I right in saying NIO is also making a car? Well, they had a supercar concept or something, or have I just made that up?
I don't know. I think you've just made that up, but mate, you know, it's a great idea. We should get onto them, and I'm sure
Justin's welcome to
them. Exactly. I'm going to go sort that out now.
Now, with that, we have reached the finish line, and I want to say thanks, Justin. And
thank you,
Matt.
Thank you.
And hats off to our Viceroy of Production Excellence, Good Vibes Manager, and herder of helpless people, Mr. Pritchard, for his blood, sweat, and tears behind the scenes. Today, he's wearing a T-shirt saying, "I shaved my balls for this," Elmo pants, and Lightning McQueen Crocs. Incredible. Let us know your thoughts. You can
watch
Cars Guide on Facebook and Instagram, or email us at comments@carsguide.com.au. If you're an Apple Podcast listener, please rate and review us. Remember, you can watch us on YouTube. And if you are already, make sure you subscribe to the Cars Guide YouTube channel so you can stay on top of all our latest reviews. But before we go, a friend of mine told me she was in a tight spot this week, found herself distraught and sobbing because she'd had a super tough day and topped it off by locking her keys in the car. But a passing soldier assured her that he could help. She said it was a little unnerving, but this bloke proceeded to take off his pants, roll them up into a ball and start rubbing them against the driver's door. Magically, the door opened. She said, "That's amazing. How did you do that?" And the soldier said, "Easy. These are my car keys."
Brilliant, as always.